From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The King is probably long gone. Long live the Cavs. Ahead on Only a Game, an Ohioan's lament over the decline and imminent relocation of LeBron James. Also, the Montreal Canadiens' stunning ride through the NHL postseason, finding free money around the betting windows with the world's most successful stupor, and a former pro hoopster hose rose on his urban farm. Also, remembering how political prisoners preserved their own sanity and reshaped South Africa by resorting to a game.
Football was a way in which the prisoners could reconnect with the ordinary, mundane reality of everyday life outside the prison. You could almost, and I emphasize almost, forget you were on Robben Island and begin to think that you were someplace else.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Flyers didn't come out flying last night in the deciding game of their NHL playoff series against the Boston Bruins. In fact, the host Bruins scored three times before Philadelphia netted the puck, and then the Flyers scored three more times to become only the third team in Stanley Cup playoff history to rebound from a 3-0 disadvantage and win the series. The team Philadelphia will face next has also been crafting an unlikely storyline. It would be an exaggeration to suggest that nobody expected the Montreal Canadiens to beat the Pittsburgh Penguins in their recently concluded Stanley Cup playoff series. Some small number of small children in Montreal probably believed. But as the number 8 seed, the Canadiens weren't given much of a chance by anybody else against the defending champions, who are led by NHL poster boy Sidney Crosby. Joining me now is Damian Cox, a columnist for the Toronto Star who has been following Montreal's unlikely progress through the playoffs. Welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me on.
In the first round of the playoffs, Montreal upset the Washington Capitals. The Caps owned the best regular season record. Should we have expected Montreal to slide by the Penguins in round two?
Well, I suppose probably if we'd been paying closer attention to what the Canadiens were doing. Instead, we were looking in the first round mostly at what the Washington Capitals weren't doing, or maybe more accurately couldn't do, and that was score, particularly their best players. And I think it was the tendency in those situations is always to look more at the vanquished as opposed to the conquerors. And in this case, the vanquished was the Washington Capitals, and it looked as though the problem was with them, that what they hadn't been able to do, they were too inexperienced, and they had other shortcomings that had come to the fore when they played the Canadiens. As it turns out, maybe the Canadiens had a little bit more going for them than they were given credit for. And certainly in the second round against the Pittsburgh Penguins, they showed that and even a little bit more. By the end of the second round of the playoffs, they were outplaying the Penguins. And so should we be surprised that they've made it this far? Probably. Should we be surprised if they keep going? Probably not.
Montreal just barely earned the right to play in the postseason, Damian. What happened in that brief slice of time between the last games of the regular season and the beginning of the playoffs to render the Canadiens so dangerous?
Well, and I think it's important to realize they needed a point in their last game, which they got while still losing to the second-worst team in the National Hockey League. So they barely made it into the playoffs, and they were the 19th best team in the NHL, a 30-team league, over the course of the season. So what happened? Well, I think one thing happened, that is that their goaltender got hot. And in hockey, that's everything. A goaltender can mask, I guess that's a pun, all kinds of shortcomings for any team. So Yaroslav Halak, the young Slovak goaltender for the Canadiens, who'd been fighting to hold the number one job all year long, finally took it and has kept it and has had some amazing performances. I think the fact that he was playing well allowed the Canadiens to get better in a whole bunch of areas. And so by the end of the Pittsburgh series, it wasn't just about Yaroslav Halak anymore. It was about a whole bunch of things that the Canadiens were doing much better in the playoffs than they'd done in the regular season.
It seems to me that winning these two series could encourage the Canadiens to begin thinking of themselves as legitimate candidates to win the Stanley Cup. Of course, they also might wake up tomorrow morning and wonder what they're doing in the semifinals, having been the 19th best team in the league during the regular season. Which seems to you more likely?
Oh, I think they've got their eye on the prize. You have to know the history of the Montreal Canadiens. I mean, not only are they the winningest franchise in the history of the National Hockey League, from time to time they've won cups when they weren't supposed to win. 1971, Ken Dryden stoned the Boston Bruins, and the Habs went on to win a cup after missing the playoffs the year before. 1986, it was Patrick Waugh doing a lot of the same things, and the Canadiens won the cup. 1993, the Montreal Canadiens did not go into the playoffs as a favorite, and at the end they ended up hoisting the cup over the Los Angeles Kings and Wayne Gretzky. So the Canadiens have this habit of every once in a while, when you least expect it, winning a Stanley Cup. And the next round, the Canadiens are more likely to go in as the favorites. And on the other side, in the Western Conference, you have a team, the San Jose Sharks, that has never won a Stanley Cup, and another team, the Chicago Blackhawks, that hasn't won a Stanley Cup since 1961. So who's the favorite then?
The Canadiens have won 24 Stanley Cups in their history. Their fans once regarded the Stanley Cup as their birthright, but the last title came back in 1993. How are fans in Montreal and beyond reacting to what's happened in the playoffs so far?
Well, there's a lot of excitement in Montreal. Now, I should say a lot of things have happened since 1993. It was only 8 or 9 years ago when the team was put up for sale and no one in the city of Montreal wanted to buy them. They were 6,000 or 7,000 seats shy of a sellout every night. The team was doing poorly. Well, in the past 3 or 4 years, they sure have come back. They play before sold-out houses every night, and probably the best hockey atmosphere there is in the game right now. Rabid, rabid fans. Has it changed? Absolutely. It's not exactly been the same thing that it was back in the day.
The much-anticipated, at least by some of us, Bruins-Canadiens conference final matchup did not materialize. Do you think fans of Montreal are disappointed that they won't see those original six rivals battle it out again?
I think there's probably a little bit of disappointment, if only because the rivalry with Boston has, you know, so many layers and so many decades and so many colorful moments over the years. But, you know, there's history between the Canadiens and the Philadelphia Flyers as well. The Canadiens were the team that sort of put the brakes on the Broad Street Bullies of the 1970s, and everybody remembers that who follows the game. And they've had meetings over the years ever since. And really, the Flyers are as unlikely a team to get to the conference final as the Canadiens are. So you're really dealing with two teams that nobody expected to be here. And I think that'll provide an exciting backdrop to what will probably be a great series.
Damian Cox writes about the NHL for the Toronto Star. Damian, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
The betting windows will be jumping at Pimlico and beyond in the lead-up to today's Preakness. Parimutuel windows opened in the 1930s in the U.S., and shortly thereafter, stupers began plying their trade. Stupers are people who pick up discarded betting slips at racetracks and off-track betting parlors in the hope that someone has thrown away a winning ticket. Only a Game's John Kalish recently caught up with a legend who has stooped for 10 years at a New York City off-track betting parlor, and he has this report.
Jesus Leonardo is 57 and lives in northern New Jersey with his wife and two teenage sons. A silver bejeweled head of Jesus Christ hangs around his neck, and his long dreadlock beard sports an Obama button. Leonardo has been stooping at an OTB parlor in Midtown Manhattan since 1999. In his characteristically thick accent, he says it all started accidentally when he threw away a winning ticket worth close to $1,500. The manager of the OTB parlor where this happened suggested he take the parlor's garbage home, and Leonardo did just that, returning the next day to feed the betting slips into the scanner.
Instead of finding the $1,495 that the pick three paid, I found $2,500 in some other tickets. And that's why I say, oh, I must continue doing this.
I must continue doing this.
Leonardo is no longer a betting man, but he is said to be generous when he wins, buying food and drink for the betting parlor regulars. He reportedly pays two friends $25 per bag of garbage that they collect each night at four OTB parlors. On his train ride home to New Jersey, Leonardo carries several thousand discarded OTB tickets with him. In the morning, he brings them back to OTB and spends hours at a ticket scanning machine checking for winners, politely moving aside if a paying customer needs the scanner. At first, his wife thought he was nuts. She has since seen that stooping can be a reliable source of income, but insists he go through the discarded tickets away from their home.
I start stooping. I cannot deny that.
I started stooping. I can't deny that. But as I've gone along, I've hired people who do it for me. And the way they do it isn't stooping. I just wait for the OTB to put the garbage out of the premises, and then on the sidewalk, I do my job.
I do my job.
It's a job that provides Leonardo with a middle-class income. He says he makes $100 to $300 a day, more than $45,000 a year. Leonardo says his biggest single win was just under 10 grand in 2006 for a pick four wager. The history of stoopers goes back to the early 1930s and the beginning of parimutuel betting. T.D. Thornton is the author of Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track.
Stoopers are part of the glorious underbelly of the sport, part of the spectacle of humanity that you only encounter at a racetrack. They're not allowed to follow people around and make them feel uncomfortable. They're also really not allowed to delve into the trash bins and pull garbage out onto the floor in an attempt to get the tickets. That's certainly frowned upon. And at most racetracks, the unwritten code of ethics also includes having the stoopers stay out of the fancy parts of the racetrack, the box seats, the clubhouse areas, until after the end of the races.
It may be hard to believe that winning tickets are discarded on a regular basis, but one explanation of the phenomenon is that photo finishes and the declaration of fouls can alter race results. Winning bets that are not cashed can amount to a substantial pile of money. One published report put that figure for racetracks and off-track betting operations in New York State at more than $8 million over a two-year period. In most tracks and OTB parlors around the country, these funds revert to the state. T.D. Thornton says with OTB operations now allowing wagers via high-tech electronics, the future of stooping for paper slips may not be so bright.
As horse racing advances, more betting is turning to account wagering, which means you bet from home on a computer, you bet at the track on a handheld device, or, for example, at the New York Racing Association tracks, you can sign up for a swipe card, which is essentially your betting account, and rather than having a slip of paper, which is your proof of a wager, you now have an account similar to an ATM transaction. So I think we're moving towards an era when you're going to see a lot less garbage on the floors of racetracks and OTBs throughout the country, and that's going to mean bad things for these stoopers.
But in the meantime, Jesus Leonardo vows he will continue stooping.
I spend 12 hours daily doing my thing, and nobody gonna put me down. I got a family like everybody else. I enjoy my life like everybody else, and I don't bother nobody.
For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Mother's Day is for flowers and a sweet card. Mother's Day is for taking Mom out to brunch. Unless you were in Huancayo, Peru last Sunday, in which case Mother's Day was for boxing. Sports promoters in Huancayo invited moms to lace up the gloves and whack away at each other. 10 women took up the challenge, which was reportedly inspired by the success of the current world flyweight champion, a Peruvian named Kina Malpartida. About 200 spectators watched as several of the participating moms wearing traditional embroidered skirts instead of boxing shorts got clocked hard enough so that they hit the canvas, which in this case was actually grass. So, was this really boxing? I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. From the pro hardwood to the urban greenhouse, Will Allen's farming initiative in Milwaukee and beyond. But first, the Cleveland Cavaliers were knocked out of the second round of the NBA playoffs on Thursday by the Boston Celtics, leading up to that Game 6. Many claimed that it would be the most important game in the history of the Cavaliers, Afterward, many Clevelanders claimed it was one of the worst losses in the history of Cleveland sports, and there have been a few really bad ones. Here to discuss LeBron Gate 2010 and what might ensue is CBSSports.com national columnist Greg Doyle, who's also an Ohio resident. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Yeah, I'm struggling, but I'll muddle through this today. How are you doing, Bill?
I do appreciate your professionalism on our behalf. I really do.
No one's ever said that to me before. Thanks.
For the past 2 years, the Cavaliers had the best regular season record as well as the league MVP in LeBron James, but they failed to make the finals. This just doesn't happen in the NBA, at least not 2 years in a row. Why couldn't Cleveland advance in the postseason?
I'll tell you what, Cleveland's record has been a mirage, and that's because the NBA is a sport where people don't really try that hard until the playoffs roll around. So the Cavaliers, you're right, have had the best record. They do have the best player, but they haven't had the best team. I've actually been riding that for a couple of years. I'll go watch them play for the first time all year, and they'll be like 55-7 is their record. And I'll write a story saying, I can't believe they're 55-7. They're not very good. And Cleveland fans hate me, and then sure enough, the playoffs come around, they lose. Why is that? Because they're finally playing teams that are trying hard. Mm-hmm. And if you try hard and you're good, like Orlando, like Boston, like the Lakers, you're better than the Cavaliers.
On Friday morning, one Cleveland Plain Dealer columnist opined that Cleveland would never, ever win a title in basketball, baseball, or football. Does everybody in Ohio feel that way?
No, that's ridiculous. The odds are they're going to win something. You know, if I play the lottery every week and live to be as old as Methuselah, eventually I'd win the lottery too. You know, Cleveland's going to win something someday. But that day's not coming very soon. I'll give the columns that credit for that. It's not coming soon, but no, come on, that's nonsense. What I can see happening in about 4, 5, 10 years, Cleveland's going to win everything. For about 3 or 4 years, they're going to become like Boston. They're going to win everything, and everybody's going to look back and say, wow, isn't that weird? It's like flipping a coin. You might get heads 10 times in a row. You know, a run of tails is coming.
LeBron James will be a free agent this summer. In a column that ran before Thursday's game, you declared your devotion to LeBron James. You stated that you certainly hoped that he would stay in Cleveland. You also concluded that he certainly would not do so. On what do you base that opinion, Greg?
Well, LeBron has been acting very decidedly un-Cleveland-loving-like in the last couple years, really. He's had the chance to re-sign some long extensions. He had the chance to accept an MVP award in Cleveland. Twice he's accepted it in Akron, making it clear, Akron's where I'm from, and Akron's close to Cleveland, but it's not the same thing. He's always winking and casting long, loving looks at Chicago or New York teams that will have the cap money to sign him this offseason. He's just made it clear that he's not sure he's coming back. And my thinking is now is that LeBron knows. I mean, I know that he knows that he should be one of the best 2, 3, 4 players in NBA history when all is said and done. He's that good. You can't get to that level without some rings. He's given Cleveland 5, 6, 7 years. They've not gotten it done for him. I can see him going somewhere else to win himself some rings so he can go down in history alongside Michael Jordan, Will Chamberlain, Bill Russell.
Starting even before he signed his most recent contract with the Cavaliers, there had been vigorous speculation about where James would go after that deal had expired. Many people still feel that he'll go to the New York Knicks, but given the way that team has been run over the last decade or so, why would he go there?
Well, the Knicks have a new GM. They got the guy that used to run the Phoenix Suns and made the Phoenix Suns a winner. They've got a coach, Mike D'Antoni. You know, this is not Isaiah Thomas's New York Knicks. You know, Isaiah Thomas had the anti-Midas touch. Everything he touched turned to lead. They're on the way up with the people they have in charge. Plus, LeBron knows, look, LeBron could go to the Knicks with a starting point guard of you and a starting power forward of me, and he's still going to win 40 games at least because he's that good. If they just, I mean, look at Cleveland. Cleveland's got Shaquille O'Neal's 90 years old. Mo Williams is not very good. Antoine Jameson can't spell his own name right. And Cleveland still won 65 games this year, whatever they did. They're going to win a lot of games wherever he goes. Question is, what city does he want to win those games in? New York City is a nice big market for a nice big superstar.
Does a guy with LeBron James' stature get to say to the general manager, yes, I'll come play for you, but my condition is that you sign some guys that I really want you to sign to sort of arrange around me so we not only win a lot of games but win a championship?
I think the way he gets to say that is everybody understands kind of like what he's doing right now with Cleveland, is that if you don't bring in guys that I want, this is the last contract you'll have me around for. And LeBron's not going to be done. You know, he's going to sign I don't know, a 4 or 5 year deal. And at the end of that 4 or 5 year deal, he'll be 29 years old. He'll have another huge contract in his future. The Knicks or whoever signs LeBron next will do whatever it takes to make him happy, because A, that'll make the team better, but B, it'll make sure that LeBron, if he wins enough and feels like you're doing what he wants you to do, he'll come back again. Because this is not a 38-year-old guy with a couple years left. He's got another decade in the NBA. Whoever signs him now wants to sign him again.
Greg, maybe it'll be therapeutic for you to talk about other teams, other players. So let's take a look at the conference finals. In the West, the Phoenix Suns will face the Lakers. Is there any reason to believe that the Suns will advance to the finals for the first time since 1993?
No, because the Lakers are now trying hard, finally. And the Lakers have just way too much talent. They got way too much size. They have too much Kobe. They have too much everything. And the Suns... The Suns have been a nice story, but they've maximized their potential. You know, they've got as far as they're going to get, but they're done. The Lakers are going to win that series in probably 5 games or less.
In the East, the well-rested Magic will face the surging and mysteriously suddenly younger Celtics. Will Boston's momentum be too much for Orlando to handle?
No, I see that series going very similarly, actually. Orlando's too big for Boston, too young for Boston. And Boston, there's something there with Boston and Cleveland. You know, Boston really, I think, plays its best against Cleveland, gets fired up. LeBron fires them up, the whole deal. They've also maxed out. You know, beating Cleveland at all was the most they were going to do, and they did it. And to their credit, they did it. But nobody really saw that coming. It's been a nice ride, Boston. Go back and enjoy your 10 trophies you won a couple years ago, because you're not winning this one.
My guess is the league has no interest in a Boston-Los Angeles final. They want to see a Suns-Magic final, because that way we're guaranteed to see a first-time champion. You agree?
I cannot imagine the league wanting anything but Boston-LA, actually. Those markets are huge. And if Tim Donaghy was around, it might even happen. But Tim Donaghy's done. So we'll get the best two teams, and the best two teams are the Lakers and the Magic. And we're going to see the dream final. We just need to get to the Eastern Conference, Western Conference finals first.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBS Sports, and he joins us from time to time to talk about football, basketball, and the abdication of thrones as well. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Bill, for having me.
The top four NBA teams will soon battle to see what the postseason will yield. Meanwhile, a former pro basketball player continues to earn national recognition by planting seeds. Milwaukee-based Will Allen has become one of the leaders of the local food and urban farming movements. He has also been getting ready to launch more efforts to try to get urban dwellers to eat healthier food. Chuck Quirnbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
In the late 1960s, Will Allen was a star basketball player at the University of Miami. Standing 6 feet, 7 inches tall, with broad shoulders, Allen made it to the pros. It wasn't the NBA, but rather the old American Basketball Association, where NBA stars like Julius Erving and Dan Issel first earned a professional paycheck. Ask Allen about the ABA, and you'll find his memories are bittersweet. He says he liked the camaraderie, but on the downside, Allen says the rotating colors of the league's red, white, and blue basketball were a distraction.
I would always look at the ball instead of the rim. So I really hated that ball.
Allen also disliked the ABA's creaky financial condition. After his team, the Miami Floridians, folded, Allen went to play in Europe. During his 3 years playing in Belgium, Allen began to connect with local farmers and talked with them about how he'd grown up on a small farm in Maryland.
On the last team I played for, I asked them to get me a place in the country, and I got 25 chickens, and I started growing some vegetables. At Thanksgiving, I would invite all the other American players that were playing on other teams over to my house.
His success at feeding his fellow players led Allen to think of a post-basketball career growing food.
We're going to get started on a tour. Probably be a few more people joining us.
34 years later, Allen leads visitors on a tour of Growing Power, his 2-acre organic farm in a low-income neighborhood in Milwaukee. It has about a dozen greenhouses where herbs and vegetables are grown year-round. In one of the greenhouses, water is recycled and used to raise fish. Allen scoops a net into a tank and brings up about 15 pink and gray-colored tilapia.
Well, that's a lot of protein to be able to get into people's homes and into their bellies. And we can get this fish from our systems into people's homes in like 1 day.
Outside the greenhouses, there's a digester to grind food waste, huge compost piles, and several goats and turkeys. Alan taps on the turkey's pen to get them to sound off. Alan says these are heirloom turkeys, an older variety of bird prized for their flavor.
And what we'll do is raise these, hold them over another year, do more breeding until we're able to get a big flock of those turkeys going here.
Growing Power also has other sites in Milwaukee, an operation in Chicago, and 8 regional training centers in the U.S. 2 years ago, the Chicago-based MacArthur Foundation awarded Alan with a $500,000 genius grant. Last year, former President Bill Clinton called Alan one of his heroes. This year, Alan made a trip to the White House for an anti-childhood obesity effort led by First Lady Michelle Obama. And this month, Time magazine named Alan one of the most 100 influential people in America. That led to another ceremony in Milwaukee.
This is the Key to the City of Milwaukee, presented to Will Alan, Milwaukee's urban farmer of Growing Power Incorporated. Will.
That's Milwaukee's Environmental Sustainability Coordinator, Eric Schamberger. He says Alan is making a difference in the city, providing nutritious meals for some of the tens of thousands of local residents who live in poverty.
You got to start small, and what I love about what's happening here is that it really truly is a grassroots movement. It's really on us as a community to pull together and make it have a dent in the fast food nation.
The recognition Alan has received has helped him tap into some support from local and national corporations. But Alan says he needs to step up his outreach to another group that seems to have financial resources, NBA players. Alan says he's not convinced that today's pro basketballers always remember the poor in urban neighborhoods.
Many of these players are African-American that dominate pro basketball. Many of them come from those poor communities. It's to look at those communities in a more holistic way and see how they can help lift up those communities with their fame and their fortune. Somebody helped you. We seem to forget that a lot of times.
Not all of the overtures Alan makes to current NBA players yield results, but he says he is starting to catch the ear of some recently retired pro players who are looking to help. And Alan plans to expand Growing Power. One of his projects is to put up a 5-story building in Milwaukee and grow crops inside it. Alan says his vertical farm would maximize space and make it possible to grow even more food in densely populated areas.
And this will give us an opportunity to show that we can cash flow this and that this will be the template, the inspiration to put up more of these around the country in areas that don't have a large footprint of land.
If Alan succeeds with the vertical farm, that may earn him more accolades. Alan says growing up, he didn't think he'd be better known for farming than for playing sports.
I knew I had some leadership qualities because I was always the leader of my basketball teams. But to have the opportunities that I've been given, especially recently, to be able to use those opportunities in a positive way is kind of where I'm at. To stay very grounded, and this kind of work that I do keeps you very grounded, you know.
And that comes from a man who used to play above the rim. For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
To view Chuck Quernbach's pictures of Will Alan and his Growing Power farm, please go to our website, onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. In my conversation with Charlie Pierce 2 weeks ago, we both wondered how the Cleveland Indians had achieved the distinction of most hated major league team, at least according to one recent survey. In an email, Holly Cashman, who hears the program on New Hampshire Public Radio, opined as follows. The caricature of Chief Wahoo is unacceptable, and it is an embarrassment to the team as well as the city. That is my reason for hating Cleveland even more than I hate the Yankees. My conversation 2 weeks ago with Matthew Side, who argues in his book Bounce that 10,000 hours of practice is the chief ingredient in the recipe for brilliant success, provoked a response from Don Gisselbeck, whose public radio station is KUFM in Montana. No doubt people gifted with the leisure to devote 10,000 hours to an activity can achieve excellence, he wrote, but Side ignores the many who have done so and missed the cut, and the child prodigies who achieve excellence on much less than 10,000 hours. This all sounds like the usual justification for oppressing the poor. If they weren't lazy, they wouldn't be poor. While hosting last week's program, Karen Given invited Charlie Pierce to comment on the story of a college golfer who had already qualified for a regional tournament to enable an opponent to also do so. The golfer intentionally tanked the last hole of his round, which Charlie found unsatisfactory. John Monaghan, who hears the program on WUOM in Ann Arbor, begged to differ. Charlie could not be more wrong about the amateur golfer who bogeyed the last hole so that another player could make the tournament, he wrote. Tell Charlie that, like the title of your show, it's only a game. And finally, Jill Ferguson, who hears Only a Game on WLTR in Columbia, South Carolina, identifies herself as a mall walker who puts in up to 3 miles a day. We also return abandoned shopping carts, she writes, and the UPS guy knows us, as do the Santa Clauses and Easter bunnies in their seasons. If I missed the broadcast in which you featured mall walking, never mind. You can suggest a sport we should explore or comment on what you've heard on the program by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can become one of our Facebook fans at facebook.com/onlyagameradio, or you can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. Summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Cameron Doyle of Brentwood, Tennessee, first became interested in bowling when he was 7. That was 5 years ago. On Sunday, Mr. Doyle earned his first check in a pro bowling tournament, the Canton Regional Open, when he finished 30th and pocketed $400. Well, not pocketed, actually, because Mr. Doyle, now 12, isn't a professional, so the check was deposited in a scholarship account to be tapped at some later date, which is fine, I guess, except that how's this kid gonna buy beer and cigarettes? Because this is bowling, right? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of apartheid's political prisoners who used soccer to maintain their health, sanity, and dignity. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The NBA Conference Finals are set to begin. First up, the Boston Celtics visit the Orlando Magic tomorrow, and then the Lakers take on the Phoenix Suns at home on Monday. Got some picks?
I don't have any picks because I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen in the East. The Celtics played the Magic a pretty decent series last year without Kevin Garnett. I don't think this Magic's team is as good as last year's Magic's team. So I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen there. I think the Lakers will beat the Suns, but I think they'll do it in 7 games, and I think it'll be a vastly entertaining series.
The Miami Heat are out of the mix, of course, but that doesn't mean the front office isn't keeping busy. The team has launched WeWantWade.com, where fans can send Wade a virtual dessert or give him a standing ovation. You think that'll be enough to keep Dwayne Wade in Miami?
Can they send him actual money? Because that's the only thing that's going to keep him there. Again, it's another one I really don't know. If they go out of their way to get him another player, if they go out of their way to get him Chris Bosch from Toronto, who's a free agent, then he may well stay. But I don't think we're going to be able to attribute it to the We Want Wade website, especially to the videos, which, by the way, really stink, even the one with the guy in the banana seat.
The San Jose Sharks will face the Chicago Blackhawks in the NHL's Western Conference Finals starting tomorrow. Are you rooting for the expansion team or the original 16?
It's entirely possible, with Montreal going through to the Eastern Conference Finals very spectacularly, I might add, that we could have a Montreal-Chicago original six final, which would be great. And if they could, like, rebuild the Chicago Stadium and the old Forum in time for it, that would even be better.
Well, you sort of stole my thunder here, Charlie, because I was going to ask you next if I were to say that what the Montreal Canadiens have accomplished is the biggest story in the NHL playoffs. Seems to me it is.
Well, there's no question. Number one, because it is the Montreal Canadiens, who still carry a lot of karmic weight in that league. And number two, because they've taken out the NHL's two biggest matinee idols, Alexander Ovechkin in the Washington Capitals in one round, and then Sidney Crosby in the Pittsburgh Penguins. Montreal pretty much has to win the Stanley Cup because they've wrecked it for everyone else.
A while back, the writers who vote for the AP Awards selected Brian Cushing as the NFL's Defensive Rookie of the Year, and then news broke that Mr. Cushing had tested positive for a banned substance, so the AP decided to vote again, and the results demonstrated what exactly?
That drugs make people stupid and crazy, and that this whole frenzy is a pathetic waste of time, as it always has been. Brian Cushing won the re-vote afterwards. And not only that, but if you're going to take a stand on an issue, by the way, I don't think anyone should take a stand on, but let's assume you want to take a stand, give it to the runner-up.
I like the writer who didn't vote for Cushing the first time and did vote for him the second time. I want to know his reason.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's exactly the same thing I would say. It would be to tell the moral arbiters and the What About the Children crowd to shut up.
I've been reading stories suggesting that Ken Griffey Jr. is likely to retire soon. Did you see the story that suggested that he had already retired and just hadn't bothered to tell anybody on the Mariners about his decision?
Baseball fans would be amazed if they knew exactly how many people actually go to the clubhouse and sleep.
During the game.
During games. Absolutely. Most DHs do. I know that for a fact.
Of course, there may be the odd DH who actually enjoys watching baseball.
I don't think there's the odd baseball player who actually enjoys watching baseball.
Permian High School.
Oh, man, I love this story.
Permian High School in Texas, long known for prowess in football, had a great basketball team this winter, in part because of the presence of a guy who must really have liked high school. Tell me of the exceptionally long pre-collegiate career of the man who's been calling himself Jerry Joseph.
Well, apparently he had been a star high school basketball player in Fort Lauderdale a few years ago. He's actually 22 years old. He's a naturalized citizen from Haiti, and apparently, there was an amateur tournament in Little Rock, and there were three Florida basketball coaches there. And they all looked up and said, dude, it's the guy who was playing in Fort Lauderdale. Now the poor guy's in jail in Odessa on a charge of, quote, presenting false identification to a police officer. And what's going to happen, of course, is the high school he played for in Texas, Permian High, made famous in Buzz Bissinger's Great Friday Night Lights, is probably going to have to forfeit the entire 2009 season.
Apparently, the New Jersey Nets...
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I love this story. This is going to be a great ongoing story.
The New
story.
Jersey Nets will soon be the property of Mr. Mikhail Prokhorov, though Representative Bill Pascrell Jr. D. New Jersey has a problem with that change in ownership. Why is that?
Okay, I do not make cultural and ethnic stereotypes lightly, but if you became a billionaire in Russia after the wall fell, you were up to something, okay? And it turns out that that this guy might have been doing business with Zimbabwe and the awful Robert Mugabe in violation of sanctions. As the New York Times put it, and I think quite politely, and as is the wont of the New York Times, things get a little murky because we're dealing with a Russian billionaire with global business interests that are not as transparent as other prospective owners. You think?
And finally, Charlie, a shopping mall in Guangdong Province, China, recently held a sporting event of sorts which caused one spectator to remark, "This must have been the brainwave of a dirty old man. Why would anyone want to take part in such a degrading spectacle?" And what was the nature of that spectacle?
Sports!
Once again, sports.
Apparently, a shopping center staged a competition to see how quickly contestants could unhook women's bras with one hand.
Mm-hmm.
And if the entire competition didn't take place in the backseat of a Chevy in the dark with a double feature playing on a drive-in movie screen, I don't particularly want to know the result, because if not, it was clearly an amateur competition.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Oh, thanks a lot, Bill.
When they were incarcerated on Robben Island as enemies of the South African state in the mid-60s, more than two decades before apartheid ended, a group of prisoners decided that what they and their fellow inmates needed was a soccer league. It might seem like a curious conclusion for a group of men suffering from exhaustion, hunger, and beatings to reach, but in more than just a game, subtitled Soccer versus Apartheid, the most important soccer story ever told, Chuck Kaur and his co-author Marvin Close argue that the determination to play organized soccer on Robben Island had profound consequences for the history of South Africa. Chuck Kaur joins me now from KWMU in St. Louis. Welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. It's great to be back with you.
How did you come across the story of the Makana Football Association?
I was teaching at the University of the Western Cape in Cape Town in 93. And a friend of mine took me into what was called the archive, and he pointed to this collection of boxes, and they were labeled in pencil, Robben Island Sports. And what I discovered was, first of all, I got lucky. The first box I opened up contained hundreds of letters that the prisoners had written to one another. And a typical letter would be the secretary of the Rangers Football Club, Robben Island Prison, Robben Island, South Africa. And it was addressed to the secretary of the Makana Football Association, Robben Island Prison, Robben Island. My dear sir, it is with great regret that I must inform you that the quality of the refereeing is every bit as bad as it had always been. We would have won the match 3-0 had not the offside calls been made incorrectly. Yours in sports. These are communal prisoners. They are showering together. They're breaking rocks together. They're being searched together. They're eating together. Why in God's name are they writing letters to one another? You know, why not just one day in the quarry tap somebody on the shoulder and say, the referee's lousy, we want another one next week? And the next box I opened up had hundreds of match reports in triplicate. These guys didn't play at football.
What was the daily life of a prisoner on Robben Island like before the establishment of the soccer league back in 1964?
Let me preface it by saying that when you mention Robben Island to virtually anybody outside of South Africa, the first thing and probably the only thing they know is this is the place where Nelson Mandela spent roughly the first 18 years of his imprisonment. I'm writing about the 95% of the prisoners who were not in the isolation section, who were not with Mandela and Walter Sisulu and Ahmed Kathrada. These are the men who were living in communal cells. They would be awakened sometime between 5 and 5:30 in the morning. The average work day was from 6:30 in the morning to whatever sunset was. And Robben Island is about 5 miles off the coast of Cape Town. The sea breezes are always there. And for the first few years, they built the breakwater, they quarried the stone, and this might sound like a rerun of the bridge on the River Kwai, but in this case it's reality. They built their own prison. And to this day, the men who worked on the prison are extremely proud of the quality of the prison. The deputy in charge of the quarry told the prisoners who arrived in 1964, "We are going to work you almost to death. What you will do is take very large stones and break those into large stones. You will break those into small stones, and you will break those into tiny stones, and you will spend the rest of your time here breaking stones." When they got to actually build something with the stones, it was gave them a degree of pleasure. They weren't just breaking stones for the sake of breaking them.
It's easy to understand that prisoners would crave an opportunity for recreation, but to what extent was the establishment of the soccer league on Robben Island a political act?
You have to understand the political prisoners are very different from convicted criminals. These guys, first of all, are in prison because they were fighting for a cause. And these are very savvy guys. and one of them got a hold of a copy of the prison regulations, which state that any prisoner who's incarcerated for more than 90 days has the right to recreation. There's also a right that any prisoner can, once a week, issue a written complaint about prison conditions. So the prisoners in the communal cells got together, and each week for 3.5 years, they would nominate 2 or 3 guys from each different cell to go make a formal written complaint that they want the right to play football, soccer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it would be turned down, and the ones who made the complaint would have their rations cut in half for the next week. That's why they had different people do it every week. And it took 3.5 years. And the chief warder said to his deputy, it doesn't matter because these guys are in such bad physical shape that they'll only play for a few weeks and then they'll forget all this foolishness. Well, they started playing football in 1967. The league ended in 1991 when the prison closed. Obviously, the chief warder didn't quite know the men he was dealing with.
After they had permission to build a soccer field and wear team uniforms instead of prison clothing, at least on the occasion of the games, what additional obstacles did the aspiring players face?
Well, part of it is just their physical condition, the bad food and hard work. But they ran a league that was unlike any other. There are 2 teams, for instance, that have to consolidate because they lost some of their best players. And this is your quintessential bad news, good news story. They lost some of their best players, which is the bad news. The reason they lost them is they had finished serving their term and they had just been released from prison. The best goalkeeper on the island, Sifo Shabalala, was released after serving 8 years. And he wrote a letter to his teammates in 1971. And he said how much it's been a pleasure to play with him, how much he's going to miss the circumstances in which they play. But in the future, when South Africa has success, and by success, he meant the end of apartheid and the creation of freedom, we will find our place amongst the giants of football. We will take our place amongst the best. Well, Sifo died a couple of years ago, but before he died, I was with him at the World Cup draw in 1997. So he knew that South Africa was going to host the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And in 1998, FIFA, the governing body of world soccer, recognized the Makana Football Association as the first ever honorary member of FIFA, and Sifo and 5 of the other founders of the league were there on Robben Island to accept the plaque and accept the membership in FIFA. It was a great day.
You write that the Makana Football Association faced its greatest challenge in the mid-70s when a group of young prisoners arrived on Robben Island with a very different mindset from some of the prisoners who were already there. What was the nature of that challenge?
The so-called Soweto generation, the ones who came to prison after Soweto uprisings in 1976, they were much younger. Most of them were school kids who went out with rocks in their bare hands and tried to take on the authorities who had automatic weapons and tanks. They came to the island, and their immediate reaction was, we're not going to cooperate with any of the guards. We're going to cause as much trouble as we can. And by the way, the men who have been serving on the island for the last 12 or 13 years must have sold out to the authorities. How could they have dreamt of building the prison? Why are they so proud of having built a prison? And for God's sake, they're getting to play soccer. Well, that means they must have given up something. They were taught by the older generation that the first goal of a political prisoner is to survive. The second goal is to maintain your dedication to the struggle. That means doing something that keeps you mentally and physically alert. And if that means not constantly bickering with the guards, then that's a compromise that's well worth making. And in a funny way, remember, these are youngsters, the Soweto generation. It was a lot easier to convince them to do that when the result of it would be to do something they wanted to do anyhow, which was play football. It's a story built around soccer, but it's not a story about soccer. It's a story about dignity. Soccer gave them a mechanism by which they could remind themselves of their essential dignity and their essential personhood.
Chuck Coor is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and the co-author of More Than Just a Game, published by St. Martin's Press. He joined me from KWMU in St. Louis. Chuck, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's been fun.
We baba, we baba, abamamuze. Tinazifuna mambuze.
Temporarily More Than Just a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Mike Schrand at KWMU in St. Louis. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the More Than Just a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, which is actually called onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word is from writer Chuck Coor, to whom the suggestion is made that the obvious tension between the title of his book, More Than Just a Game, and the title of our program might be resolved temporarily, retitling the show More Than Just a Game.
I wouldn't oppose that.
Already did it. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. We'll be Only a Game again.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.